That's the sound of musician and philosopher David Rothenberg serenading a humpback whale with his clarinet. And as you can hear, the whale, incredibly, seems to be singing back. This is part of David Rothenberg's personal quest to play music with animals. A few years ago, he did it with songbirds. Now he's released a new recording of duets played in the wild with humpback whales, belugas, and orcas. He's also written a book about the experience. It's called Thousand Mile Song. Rothenberg told Steve Paulson that he's always been fascinated by the way musicians have worked recorded whale songs into their music, but he wanted to try something different.
I really wanted to take my own approach, which is to go out and play live with these animals, take my clarinet and play along with whales. Of course, they're underwater, and I'm above the water. So how do you do this? Well, you take the clarinet and play it into a microphone that goes into an underwater speaker, broadcasts the clarinet into the sea, and the whales can listen. And then meanwhile, you have another microphone underwater called a hydrophone. And there I'm listening to what the whales are doing together with what I'm playing, even though I'm staying dry on the boat.
So what kinds of whales were you trying to play music with?
Well, humpback whales are the ones with this famous, long, complex musical song that's really the longest song made by any animal, probably longer than human songs, because they actually can sing for up to 24 hours in a very structured way. The song itself is about up to half an hour in length that they're repeating in a very organized, structured way.
So you're saying for a half an hour at a time, that's kind of a song in itself. There's a particular structure within that.
There is, which was amazingly discovered and described by Scott McVeigh and Roger Payne in 1970. And since that description of that song, people have tried to figure out more about what it means, when it's sung, what it's for, and in a way we haven't learned all that much about it because it's really hard to figure out what these whales are up to down there. We know they're singing this incredible music and there's certain surprising things about it, like it's always changing, but they're all singing the same song.
All the whales within a particular pod are singing the same
song. Oh, within a particular ocean, not just a pod, but in one ocean, or in one half of an ocean, North Pacific or South Pacific. In the North Pacific, all the humpback whales are singing one song, and it changes. Some innovation appears. All the whales pick it up right away, and they sing it together. So unlike certain birds, the whales are not trying to distinguish themselves by singing something different. They all want to sound the same. If they all want to sound the same, why bother changing it at all? We don't know. No other animal does anything quite like that.
And isn't it true that only the males of humpbacks are the singers?
That's true. Only the males sing these long, beautiful, complex songs, and usually happens during the mating season, in the winter, in the tropics. And so most scientists want to believe it's to attract the attentions of females. However, we've never seen a female humpback whale show any interest in a whale who's singing. So maybe it's about something else entirely. I talk about these scientists, Jim Darling and Flip Nicklin, who spent 10 years really paying attention to what happens when a male humpback whale is singing, alone, all by himself, suspended, kind of motionless, 40 feet down in the water. Most of the time, a whale sings alone, stops singing, goes off. You see no interaction. But when they did see another whale approach, which they only saw about 200 times in 10 years, it's not that much, they have to go out a lot, what they saw was this. Another male whale arrives. The first one stops singing. The two of them go off silently together for a few minutes, and then they separate, also in silence. What does this mean? What's happening? We have no idea.
Are you willing to speculate? I mean, one of the virtues of talking with you is you're not a scientist. You're a musician right. Who likes to kind of think about big questions.
I'll tell you what, Jim concludes, and he does so in a tentative way, because after all, his research boat is named The Never Satisfied, which is just great. He's never satisfied with what he's come up with. We just don't know that much about these whales. He says somehow this song must help to organize the males together in a way that's necessary for mating to happen somehow. Musically, I kind of think bird song and humpback whale songs are examples of how animals actually make music. They communicate, but they're not communicating information in a way we could translate and say this sound means that or this sound means this in a very clear way. They're singing a performance, has a beginning, middle, and end. Certain notes are right, certain notes are wrong. evolution has produced music in the natural world much more than it's produced language. These animals are really singing. We're not just calling them songs. Bird song doesn't have a lot of information in it. They're pieces of music, and these animals have evolved to make music.
Are there any similarities between bird songs and whale songs?
Oh, between humpback whale songs, yes. If you speed up a humpback whale song, it sounds a lot like a kind of rhythmic bird song, like a mockingbird or a nightingale. You know, it's not the same structure, but you hear a lot of the similar kinds of elements put together. What does that show, that there's a similarity? I mean, it shows a kind of thing that there, at different levels of life, there's kinds of patterns that are produced by whole different evolutionary paths, where whales evolved one way, birds some other way, but they're making similar kind of music. Does that mean this music is universally beautiful, appreciated the same way by different species? We don't know.
Also makes you wonder if they're just doing it for fun.
They might be, you know. It's easier for scientists to cut open dead whales and see what's going on in their brain rather than observe what they're doing because they're so big and they can't live in captivity. But they found in the brains of humpback whales something called a spindle neuron, a kind of neuron that previously was only found in animals that we think can experience higher order kinds of emotions, like primates. And now the same kind of neuron is in the brains of whales. One more bit of evidence that, not necessarily that they're smart, but that they can really feel. They have intense feelings.
And yet, what's so mysterious, of course, is that we really don't know anything about the emotional lives of whales. I mean, we know a lot about chimpanzees. We can sort of guess because they're so closely related to us and act in many similar ways. But whales, these extraordinarily intelligent animals, are so different and, because of that, so mysterious.
Absolutely. And I think it's really the song of the humpback whale that really led people to care about these animals. When we heard that song, we first heard it, it was immensely captivating, moving, and beautiful, and made these animals that previously were just thought of as large sources of oil and meat, that they had this sound, this feeling. And I describe in the book Scott McVeigh's trip to Japan, where he was playing these songs for all of these important people in the government and whaling industry and such, and playing these songs that no one knew about. You know, he describes how this one whaling executive just sort of starts to burst into tears. We didn't know, we didn't know. We had no idea that they were singing. On the other hand, they're still killing as many whales as they can out there.
Right.
Later he asked a friend about that, a Japanese scientist, who says, oh, in Japan, ethics very slippery. As it probably is everywhere in the world. Right. You know, people can be moved by something and then turn around and forget about it when they thinking about something else, but there's no doubt that these songs are moving and beautiful.
You have a remarkable recording from Hawaii, which you call Never Satisfied, and it sounds like you and the humpback whale are riffing off of each other. Do you think the whale was really responding to your clarinet?
I believe so. You know, I have no proof in the scientific sense. I have to do 100 of these things and study differences. But one example can be enough for music, and I really hear that there's this real interaction. And if you know that these animals change their songs very rapidly, even from week to week, presumably someone comes up with a new idea and others copy it. It's no surprise to me that they would respond to a clarinet much faster than, say, a bird would. Birds take longer to change their songs. So it didn't surprise me. It surprised a lot of scientists I played this to. They said, you made this up. This is a studio concoction. I said, well, no, other pieces on the record are studio creations, but this is live underwater clarinet and humpback whale. This is what happened.
We've been talking mainly about humpback whale songs, but other whales also sing. Belugas, for instance, what do they sound like?
Well, belugas use sound in a more conversational way with a lot of different syllables, much more like dolphins, and people have tried to communicate with them for a few decades and teach them sounds. And in aquariums, belugas are very good at learning human sounds. And I practiced in the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. playing clarinet for 3 days along with belugas there. And on the third day, you know, a whale was definitely copying some of the sounds that I made. Then I went to the wild in Russia, in the White Sea, in the Republic of Karelia, in the Arctic, to play along with wild belugas. And there, I sat on shore, waited till the whales came. They came wherever the tide was high. Same kind of thing with the hydrophone, listening underwater, the underwater speaker. And there you had a much more alien-sounding mix of clarinet with squeaks and rattles and all kinds of crazy sounds. And there, you know, I have much less of a sense of what's going on there.
What other species of whales did you play music with?
I also played with orcas, or killer whales, off Vancouver Island. And the sounds of these whales, particularly that population of them, are the most studied. When you hear the sound of an orca in the Pacific Northwest, you can identify exactly which pod and family and clan it's from, because each one has different sounds.
It suggests that there's something about culture going on here. I mean, if each group has its own sound, its own distinctive sound, I mean, these sounds bond them together in some way.
That's right. It's generally believed that the behavior of many different species of whales is a form of culture, which means it's behavior that's learned and passed down from parents to children, from one generation to the next. It's not genetic. Like, you can have two groups of killer whales, of orcas, living in the same area. One group just eats fish, and the other group eats mammals, and they have whole different behaviors associated with the kind of hunting they do to get this different kind of prey, and this includes different kind of sounds. So this is generally believed to be a kind of culture-learned behavior different groups of whales have that distinguish one group from another, even when they're living in the same place, which is very unusual among animals, you know, overlapping populations living in whole different ways.
Philosopher David Rothenberg writes about playing his clarinet with orcas in his new book, Thousand Miles Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. Steve Paulson talked with him.